It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. French food made Francis Malman South America's star chef. Suddenly, at his height, he turned 180 degrees to discover himself in fire.
Fire is such a fragile and a beautiful thing. People think that it's a manly thing, you know, fire and you burn things. But it's on the contrary, it's very feminine, it's very fragile, and I love it. And I'm learning a lot still. It's like everything in cooking. If you think about a risotto, or today I was writing a new recipe of a profiterole. When you cook, you have to be there, you know.
That was Chef Francis Malman on cooking and life. Stay with us for lots more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Francis Malman may be the best-known chef in South America, between his eateries and his 32 years of television shows. What got my attention was his book, Seven Fires, based on the traditions of the native peoples of Argentina and Venezuela. Now, here was a French-trained chef with famous French restaurants cooking in the most primal and tricky-to-control way possible. Well, we asked him to be part of our 20th anniversary stage show at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul. Before bringing him on stage, I showed a clip from his appearance on Netflix's Chef's Table. Francis was with friends in the wilds of his home, Patagonia. They were building a domed cage of branches arched over a circle of slow-burning fire. He suspended trussed chickens from that dome to cook. Well, as the clip ended, Francis walked on stage, a big man in jeans, a worn beret, a poncho that had seen a lot of his life, an old silk scarf, and a grin.
Have a seat. It's an honor to have you here because I've been a fan. I think we spoke several years ago when your book called The Seven Fires came out.
Yes.
And I remember you wrote about fire in a way that went far beyond cooking and yet in many ways actually defined what cooking is, the transformation. But I'm curious to know, what is going on there? What was happening? Is that a festival or a feast? Was it something that you just do with friends?
Well, no, that's something I've been doing for the last 2 years. It's sort of a new thing, which is dome cooking. I do these domes with wires, and I hang food. Like, I hang whole very big fish on bamboo beds and whole ribeyes on their bone, or chicken, or turkeys, and we cook them extremely slowly. So what we do is we make a round fire all around it, and the food is hung in the middle. And for example, a ribeye, we will cook it for 10 hours, and a fish for very, very slowly for 6, and it's so tender and moist.
One of the things that you talk about, this book, Seven Fires, maybe you should explain what the seven fires are.
Okay, so seven fires are the technique I sort of grabbed from my country and some parts of South America.
That's
and
Argentina.
I used to cook, yeah, Argentina. Yeah. So we have a grill that we all know. We have a plancha with a fire, which is a cast iron grill. We have a curanto, which is cooking in a pit with hot stones. And there are some traces of that that are 12,000 years old in Patagonia. So the natives were cooking like that 12,000 years ago.
You were raised in Patagonia.
I was raised in Patagonia, yes.
Which is a wild place.
It is, and I certainly love it. And then we have asador, which is cooking on sort of a stand, a whole animal. We do a big cow, or we do a lamb or a goat. Sometimes on wood crosses or iron crosses, and we're cooking very, very slowly, quite far away from the fire too, and we brine it with water and salt. And then we have the wood oven, and we have as well rescoldo, which is cooking in ashes. So those are the techniques plus the dome now, which is hanging.
But these are very traditional techniques from your country.
Most of them, yes. And a little hell, which is cooking in between two fires, that comes from the Incas.
Now, you're opening a new restaurant in Miami next month.
That's right.
And it's called Los Fuegos.
Yes.
Meaning the fires.
Yeah.
What is it with fire? I mean, what, for you, what is it? No, I should preface this by saying that I think this is something that, well, I personally feel very strongly about this. I think there's a draw. We all know this. We love sitting in front of them, et cetera. But you have turned this into something that is a life. Yeah. And I'd love to know, what is that about?
Well, if you look a bit into my background, I was raised in Patagonia in a house that was ruled by fire. You know, we had chimneys, the hot water system was with a fire, the heating of the house. So as kids, you know, having a full shed of wood was very important, of every size for every different fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I never remembered that. And then I went into training in France with the best star chefs of those times. And I came back to become an arrogant French chef. I was for many years. I tried to copy everything I had learned in a very bad way, I think. And then suddenly I was 40 and I got this sort of a prize in Paris. And I thought, well, what the hell am I doing? You know, I'm 40, I've been cooking for 20 years. Who am I? So I said, I better start thinking about having my own language in cooking. And I didn't invent anything, really. I just went down into my knees and looked around and remembered all the tools from my childhood and looked around a bit into the mountains and see what the natives had been doing. And I grabbed all that and I started cooking it with it. But it was very slowly. It was a process that took, you know, the last 20 years. And I feel that I just started. You know, there's so much more to do because fire is such a fragile and a beautiful thing. People think that it's a manly thing, you know, fire and you burn things. But it's on the contrary, it's very feminine. It's very fragile, and I love it. And I'm learning a lot still.
And it's very hard to control, isn't it?
Well, it is very hard to
control. The quixotic side of it, is that one of the things that draws you in?
Well, it's like everything in cooking. If you think about a risotto, or today I was writing a new recipe of a profiterole. When you cook, you have to be there, you know. Yes, you can put something in a wood oven and walk away for 5 hours and maybe we'll be okay. But, you know, when I put something in the oven, I feel like my wife has a lover. And I look into the oven and I say, what the hell are you doing with my chicken? I mean,
How dare you?
How dare you? Yeah, it's warm in there. I'm out here. What are you guys doing in there? So I sit by the oven when I cook, you know, because I think about that. And I look at it. Well, that's a joke, but I think that, you know, we have to be very aware when we cook. And I love that. You know, nowadays, you know, I have a lot of help when I do with these big fires. I have a comfortable chair like today and I point, do this, do that. Because I'm grown up, you know, and I have the right to do it now. But I'm still there for the 20 hours of the cooking. I love it. Uh-huh. It's 20 hours when we do these fires. We start at midnight and we finish at midnight next day.
And then everybody's feasts.
Yes.
You talk about living on the edge. Did I interpret that?
Yeah, the edge of uncertainty.
Yes, yes.
Well, my life has been a bit like that. You know, I've always chose that sort of edge. It sounds dangerous, but it has more to do with risk and with doing new things and with starting again constantly, you know, not being comfortable. I think that the worst enemies we have in life are routine and fear. They're two things that paralyze us, you know. When you're afraid, and when you're in routine too, it's so sad. So my TV shows nowadays are more about a lifestyle, trying to push people outside, making them dream that there's a better life, you know, that you can work and go to the office, but you have to be outside a bit. And kids, you know, until they're 7, they should spend half of the day in the wild. It's the best school. I hate schools. Every day that my children, I see them go to school, I'm so unhappy. I don't like schools. They indoctrinate. They take the dreams away of children.
Were you raised with that kind of freedom?
Yes. It wasn't that my parents taught, but we lived, you know, in a very remote place. And my father used to give us money to pay the school, to do the bus to school in, but not out. So, you know, we got to school, we spent the day at school, and the way back we had to walk or, you know, hitchhike or... And without thinking it, you know, we spent... I remember hours and hours, you know, walking with my dogs in the fields after school every day, and that saved my life because every time I'm hurt, every time I see adversity in my life, I remember of that, and it's just a cleansing. It's the best medicine.
I wanted to take you back to perhaps not such a gifted moment.
Okay.
You mentioned being very arrogant and doing French food.
Yes.
Right? And I understand that one of the perhaps turning points was when the president of Cartier came to your restaurant for dinner.
Yeah.
Maybe could you tell that story?
Well, you know, I came back from France. I was 27. I had worked with 8 of the 3-star chefs of those days. Late 70s, early 80s. And I thought, you know, I thought I was the best. I had trained with these guys and I was doing my menus and trying to copy every recipes I had learned in all the good restaurants of France. And I did. And one night the restaurant was booked by the president of Cartier, and very elegant man, I remember him. He, you know, I was walking around the room after dinner with my hat, like a turkey, very happy. And the man said to me, very kindly, can I talk to you? And I said, yes. So we went, he took me to the side, and he said to me, you know, I know you've been in France. I know you love France. I know you worked very hard. The menu was in French, but the food was in French. You know, this is not very good food. I'm very sorry to say this, but I didn't enjoy this meal. So I looked at him and I said, well, thank you very much, sir. And, you know, and I parted. And I got home and I thought, well, this guy, you know, he makes wonderful watches and jewels and rings and so on. But what does he know about cooking? I thought, you know, but I never forgot it. And many, many years later, I realized that he was right. He had read in my life something that I still didn't know, but it was very important. So nowadays, I feel that one of my responsibilities is to tell young chefs those sort of messages, not in a harsh way, but we must, because you don't forget those things, and they help you grow in life.
And that's very true.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. This has been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Talk about one of a kind. Francis Malmon is author of Malmon on Fire. Now you can find his recipe for pork loin chops with thyme oil and roasted grapes on the vine at splendidtable.org. Coming up, slow cooking Chinese style. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Kian Lam Ko grew up in Singapore. In the 1970s, he came to the United States to study software engineering. His blog, Red Cook, grew out of his homesickness for the authentic Chinese food of his family. Well, software design fell away as those blog posts morphed into his first book, Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. He goes against the tide by building the book around how his Chinese dishes are cooked. Yes, he talks stir fries, but then takes us into methods we rarely try. Our contributor, Melissa Clark, got into these when she talked with Kian in New York.
Hi, Kian, welcome.
Thank you.
Kian, I love your book, and I love the way it's organized. You organize it by cooking method rather than by ingredient. What made you decide to organize your book that way?
Well, The reason I decided to do that is because I really feel Chinese food has been misunderstood. And so I feel that organizing it by techniques will give people a full broad range of idea of exactly what kind of cooking methods and how to utilize the different heat sources to actually prepare Chinese food. And, you know, most of these techniques, even though they have sort of closely related to a Western technique, but they're really quite different.
I think most Americans know technique as stir-frying. They think Chinese food, and that's what they think. But I know that in your book you have some critiques about the way we've been doing our stir-fries.
Well, it's not really a critique, but just an explanation of how, you know, the Chinese actually have variations of stir-frying, and one of them is dry stir-fry, which really means that you only add a little bit of the sauces, and the end result is the sauce just coats the ingredients, and there's no gravy with it. That's moist stir-fry, on the other hand, is that you add extra stock or extra liquid, and in the end, you actually have a sauce, a gravy that is accompanying the final dish. Now, that there's a third technique that's called simple stir-fry, and that one very often is reserved for leafy vegetables. In a leafy vegetables stir-fry, when you cook them, they bleed a lot of liquid, and you don't want to add additional protein or additional ingredients, because then it will be just sitting in a pool of liquid that's basically tasteless. So often when we do the other kind of stir-fry, we don't use leafy vegetables.
So leafy vegetable stir-fry is its own special category.
Correct.
Now, what about red cooking? You've named your website after red cooking, and I know that's very important. It's an iconic style of cooking. Tell me about that.
Right. Red cooking is the most common braising technique that is used in Chinese cooking. In fact, you know, when I was growing up, we eat red cooked pork every other week. And it's like, there's just so many different kinds of red cooking. You can red cook lamb, you can red cook chicken, fish, beef. It's just endless varieties. And, you know, it's actually a very simple technique. The basic ingredients are three, which is sugar, soy sauce, and wine. And then, of course, you add in aromatics and you add in a little bit extra spices depending on the ingredients that you're cooking with. So it's a very flexible and it's very simple technique. So we basically red cook everything.
Because it's so good.
It is so good.
Now, what about browning? I know that I think that you say in the book that you do brown sometimes, but not always with braising. And in the U.S., we think of a braise as a very traditional French
Correct.
Dish where you brown it first and then add liquid. But it's different.
Right. That is very different in Chinese technique. Almost all of the braising and stewing type of dishes in Chinese cooking, we parboil the protein instead of browning the protein. We parboil in plain water, and we scoop off all the scum or residue that floats on to the top. And very often we discard the parboiling liquid before we even start braising it. So, you know, the result is that you end up with this braise that has a beautiful, clean, velvety sauce with no impurities in it, with no scum, anything. So that's the reason why we actually parboil our protein.
What about steam braising? That's yet another type of Chinese braising that you write about.
Right, right. Steam braising is actually a very interesting technique, because what you do is you actually put all the ingredients into a covered clay pot and then put the clay pot in a much larger pot that has a little bit of water at the bottom and start steaming it. And you just keep steaming it for hours. And basically, you're braising the meat at 212 degrees Fahrenheit, so it's a constant boiling temperature. And the end result is just amazing, because it really infused the flavor and at the same time also tenderized the meat. Now, one of the advantages of this technique also is that if you include herbal medicine, for example, you know, like the pseudo ginseng or sometimes goji berries and, you know, all the common herbal ingredients, as you very slowly steam the braise itself, the compound from those herbal ingredients actually slowly infuse into the stock.
So it's a combination of traditional Chinese medicine and traditional Chinese cooking, and then that dish is served to someone as a curative.
That's
as well
correct.
As,
yes.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
What about smoking?
The traditional way of smoking is to actually allow the smoke coming out from a wood-burning stove through an exhaust at the back of the stove and you put a meat right behind it. But obviously nowadays we don't have that kind of a stove anymore. But it's possible to actually smoke now in a wok. You can actually line the wok with some foil and throw in some tea, some camphor wood, sometimes even orange peel, dried tangerine peels and so on, fruits, and just let it smoke. And then you can actually smoke fish, you can smoke duck, you can smoke chicken. There's all kind of different ways of smoking. And it's a very interesting way of infusing flavors into the meat.
And this is like a hot smoking. So you're cooking it at the same time that you're infusing the smoke flavor into it.
That is correct. The Chinese smoking technique is a hot smoking. So you are basically cooking the meat as you smoke.
Kian, it's been so great to talk to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Kian Lamco is author of the award-winning Phoenix Claws and Jade Trees. Melissa Clark's new book is Dinner, Changing the Game. Now, Kian left us with a classic Chinese slow-cooked recipe, red-cooked pork, which is so good. You can find it at splendidtable.org. You know, if you have an old family recipe for a chocolate cake or chocolate cookies or even brownies, and you've not been able to make them taste as you remember, I'm here to tell you, you're not imagining things. Chocolate has changed, and that means our recipes have to change. So for some guidance, we're turning to the baker's baker, Alice Medrick, a woman who has probably done more work with chocolate than anybody else I know. She's the author of Seriously Bittersweet. Alice, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be back.
So, Alice, how is our chocolate different today?
We have a lot of chocolates, both domestic and from all over the world, that have more pure chocolate in them and less sugar. And that can profoundly affect the recipes that we make with them.
What do those numbers mean? Because that's the new thing, the percentages.
That is a big new thing. The percentages on the bar are telling us how much of the bar is pure chocolate as opposed to sugar. Now, when I say that, I'm really talking about dark chocolate. Let's put milk chocolate aside for now,
okay,
because there's
sure.
more complications there. But if you see a bar called dark chocolate or semi-sweet chocolate or bittersweet chocolate, it has a number on it, that's telling you the percentage of that bar that is pure chocolate.
So the more intense chocolate flavor will be at the higher percentages.
Yes. Okay. Exactly, because less sugar. The chocolate is bitter to begin with, and if you increase that and decrease sugar, you're getting quite a bit of extra flavor and bitterness, which can be a very good thing or can be a problematic thing for baking and making desserts.
This is a time of year when we look at a lot of old family recipes. If I use, the big deal now is a 70% chocolate. In a recipe that used to just call for bittersweet, will it be the same?
That's the perfect question. No, it will not. If you have old recipes from family or things you've been making for dozens and dozens of years that you love, regardless of the fact that it may call for semi-sweet and bittersweet chocolate, you should look for a chocolate with 60% or even less cacao percentage, because back in the day, when that recipe was published, whether it was in a magazine or a newspaper or in a favorite cookbook, the chocolates that we had available and the chocolates that were used to create these recipes were all under 60% cacao.
So they were sweeter.
They were sweeter. And that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but the recipe was perfected with a sweeter chocolate. And if you switch to a much less sweet chocolate, you're not just going to get more chocolate flavor. Unfortunately, you might get some textures that don't work and maybe even too much bitterness. So the cacao percentage doesn't just affect sweetness. It profoundly can affect textures and how it feels in your mouth, as well as sweetness and flavor.
So if I do want to up the chocolate intensity of that old recipe, and I do want to use a 70% chocolate instead of a 60 or 50, what do I need to do?
Well, you know, that puts you into the realm of experimentation. You know, my book deals with that.
You've got formulas,
but
don't you?
In general, I have formulas that put you in the ballpark and help you make those translations. But getting back to your specific question, you would have to use, in most recipes, less chocolate and maybe adjust sweetness a little bit. Even if you want a more bittersweet flavor, you often have to adjust a little sweetness and use less chocolate, and sometimes you need to increase a little liquid. So it's a little more complicated than, okay, here's the how-to. Because those percentages mean so much to how the chocolate performs in a recipe, it's better now to shop by percentage and disregard the terms bittersweet and semi-sweet.
Ah, okay. You took a beloved old recipe, a great French classic, and evidently you threw pastry chefs a real curve. What did you do? It was chocolate mousse. You got to talk about what you did.
Well, you know, let me back up a teeny bit. I was interested in all the new kinds of chocolate coming into the market. And as I tasted them, I realized that they all had different kinds of flavor profiles. And I thought, well, if these flavors are going to come through in the recipes that we want to make, what kind of recipes do we need to not bury the distinctive, you know, flavors in the chocolate?
Right.
So I decided, you know, less fat, less cream, less dairy. And I ended up with chocolate mousse made with water, partly because I wanted to taste all the nuances in the chocolate, partly because my brother was coming over and he is lactose intolerant.
Reason.
So I thought, okay, let's make the mousse with water. And it was stunningly good. It was stunningly good. It was, the chocolate flavors were very clear and clean and delicious. And then I put whipped cream on top of some of them and not on his.
But, you know, that's really interesting. You put whipped cream on top of something that's very, you know, pure chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the effect is completely different than if you fold the cream into it.
Exactly. I love this comparison. Think about, you know, what tastes more chocolatey, chocolate ice cream or vanilla ice cream with great chocolate sauce on it. I personally love the contrast thing that goes on. And I think if you take a chocolatey dessert that's not too loaded with butter and cream itself and put whipped cream next to it, you intensify that chocolate flavor because there's this huge and wonderful contrast going on.
That, you know, great tip. Alice, thank you, and very happy holidays to you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Alice Medrick is the author of Seriously Bittersweet, and you can find that recipe for that water chocolate mousse. It's called Albert's Mousse, and it's on the website SplendidTable.org. Okay, we know. I mean, we harp on and on about the glories of homemade stock. Well, while its virtues are legendary, we have found options. Mock stocks. This new and, I think, brilliant take is the brainchild of Chef Susan Voland. A classically trained chef, Susan was a recipe editor for Nathan Myhrvold's legendary Modernist Cuisine project. She claims mock stocks hide in our cupboards. And she proves the theory in her book, Mastering Sauces, The Home Cook's Guide to New Techniques for Fresh Flavors. Our producer, Sally Swift, got a lesson.
Susan, nice to have you with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
So let's just start at the beginning. How do you define the term sauce? What does that mean to you?
I think a sauce is a global term. And I think sauces tend to be kind of clustered as to being very French. And so I think a sauce can be a flavorful broth. I think it can be a salsa and a chunky fresh ingredient. I think it can be creamy or bright. But it doesn't always have to be French, and that's kind of the point of the book. They can be really easy.
That's exactly right, which gets me to the point of this interview, your brilliant ideas on mock stocks. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I realized that in traditional sauce-making books and lessons, in terms of teaching people how to make sauces, is they're like, okay, you have to start with giant vats of bubbling veal bones. And they have to stay on your stove for, you know, 48 hours, and they have to be strained perfectly and reduced into this particular gel and concentration. And I think that is an intimidating spot, when in actuality, the value of stock is crucial. I mean, it's a wonderful flavor and liquid complexity, but it doesn't need to be that complicated. And so I decided to back way up and say, we don't have to start with 48 hours in veal bones. We can start making liquids flavorful like you would a cup of tea. So I developed these different mock stocks and infusions and ideas where you, in 5 or 10 minutes, you could make a more complex liquid that will be a step up from plain water.
So give me an example of something that you would use to make a mock stock.
I think you can use dried mushroom infusions, and I think sun-dried tomatoes and onions and carrot tops make a really good quick infusion if you put that in water. I love shrimp shells simmered in a little cold water on the stove while you're doing your stir fry or getting your ingredients prepped. I like an apple peeling, even thrown together with a slice of ginger. You're going to add that flavor to your pan sauce. It's going to be vegetarian, and it's going to be a lot fresher and more natural than grabbing a cube or a can of something in your cupboard.
One of the more unusual things that you talk about is cheese water.
Cheese water is very interesting. It is something I learned about.
Yeah. Doesn't sound all that great, I have to say.
But. It does. Cheese water sounds kind of sweaty, doesn't it? But no, it's something that I learned from the Modernist Cuisine team when I was testing the recipes for their books. And they would grate beautiful cheese, combine it with water, and then cook it in a sous vide tank at a moderate temperature, and then strain it. So you'd have this wonderful liquid with all of those soluble aged cheese flavors. Because cheese flavors are water soluble.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wanted to test that out with something a little bit more simple. And I don't know about you, but sometimes my cheese drawer gets some dried bits and pieces that I don't get to as quickly
and
as I want to.
And those Parmesan rinds.
Little Parmesan rinds, something that got a little more air than it should. So I take those and use that same concept, but instead of using a sous vide pot, I grate them up and pour boiling water over them, stir them with a wooden spoon, and let them sit for about 5 or 10 minutes. The solids will drop to the bottom of the bowl, and then you just decant or pour off the top, and you have this liquid, virtually fat-free, cheese-flavored water that you can use to cook vegetables, or you can add to your pasta sauce, or you can splash into your cream sauce. It's not as perfectly flavored. It doesn't have that natural cheese flavor, but it is a great way to get that flavor without the texture, with just that soluble flavor into your foods.
That's such an interesting idea. I love that. These seem to me to be great opportunities to brew up some things that would be alternatives to wine for people who don't use alcohol.
I've used tamarind water a lot in as a wine substitute, a thin tamarind. So you take tamarind pulp and you add a little bit more hot water than you would use regularly. And it's quite clear at that point, and it's tangy and it's fruity and it has sort of a depth of flavor. And as opposed to using grape juice or non-alcoholic wine, it's something you can throw together that holds in your cupboard, and you can use that to splash into darker foods, to use as wine in stocks, just to add that fruity complexity without having an open bottle or breaking open a bottle.
That's a great idea. You know, it seems to me that if I open my cupboard, there are a lot of things in there that I could use to make mock stocks.
Here's one of my favorites. If you've ever gone on one of those sort of, you know, international food experimental binges, and I tend to go, you know, I tend to go to the Asian market and just stock up on all this great stuff for a couple of recipes, and then I look in my cupboard and I've got an entire globe of dry ingredients in there. And so, yes, we've talked about the dry mushrooms, and I don't usually use the expensive dry mushrooms. I use the big forest mushrooms that aren't too expensive. And then I also tend to have dried anchovies for making Korean broths and soups, and I often have dried shrimp for Thai cooking and some Latin American cooking. And I will definitely grab those dried components in my cupboard and simmer them with a little bit of water. And then I have this wonderfully savory and very umami-rich cooking liquid, but I didn't have to rely on an instant product.
Makes perfect sense. Thank you so much for coming in.
I appreciate it. Thanks for inviting me.
Susan Voland is author of Mastering Sauces, The Home Cook's Guide to New Techniques for Fresh Flavors. Find her guide to mock stocks and simple infusions and a recipe for carrot caraway broth on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, your questions. I can't wait to connect. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Hello, who's that speaking, please?
It is time to turn to your calls. Get to us any way you want. Facebook, Twitter, send us an email, splendidtable.org. And of course, pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Bridget is calling from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Bridget, what important thing do you want to talk about? Or unimportant thing?
Well, Lynn, we just recently became part of a supper club. And my husband and I are hosting this month, and the host gets to choose the menu and sends out recipes to everybody. And so we were thinking of a theme, and we thought about mid-century because we own a mid-century 1956 house that we've been working on and love the vintage dinnerware, fiesta, all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
But we got stuck because everything I've looked up for mid-century is kind of like aspics or prepackaged Jell-O, and we want to make actually good food, so we need some help.
Well, you have to remember that at that time, all of that was so new, and some of it was might seem funny today, but some of it kind of worked out pretty well too. One of the things that I remember vividly was cocktail meatballs. Now, these were little meatballs, and you could do them with, you could do them with turkey, you could do them with beef, you could do them with lamb. They were generally done with beef, and as I remember, there was breadcrumbs in there and a little milk and onion. Now, personally, between me and thee, I'd spiff it up with a lot of parsley, some fresh herbs, maybe a little cheese. But the idea is this: you can do ahead. Okay. Yeah. And you can serve these, you know, you'd have toothpicks, right? And the thing you did with them was, it was essentially a grape jelly sauce.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, but this is the thing about it. It was kind of interesting. It was really like sweet tart.
Okay.
So you might brown onion. Again, I'd throw in a bit of garlic. And I think, you know, people use garlic then. Anyway, a bit, you know, minced onion, a bit of garlic, and then do a combination of some nice broth, okay, simmer that down a bit, and then stir in a bit of vinegar and cook that down. Do the vinegar first. Cook the vinegar down to nothing, then add the broth. And just simmer it until it gets rich tasting. And then you stir in the grape jelly to taste. And the idea was that you put this out in a chafing dish so it was hot. Now that you can just take, you know, you can even put it in a shallow dish and put it in the oven and then bring it out hot. And that would be one thing. The other thing, cream spinach was a big deal then.
Okay.
Okay. Now for main dish, let's think. Oh, you know what was a big deal? Standing rib roast.
Ooh, that sounds good. And we'll make the main dish, so that sounds like
yeah, and this was essentially, it could be lamb, it could be pork, it could be beef. Now, you'd usually have a butcher do this. But what you do is you take like a whole loin of pork and you have the rib chops.
Yeah.
And what you're going to do is pull the two ends together with the bones on the outside, and then you're going to tie them or use a needle. You know, there are needles that have very big, you know, they're for doing this kind of thing. And you use.
And so is it kind of like a ring?
Yeah. And it looks like a crown. And the idea is you marinate it first, and then you can roast it, and then put into it things like hot rice with vegetables and fruit and that kind of thing. And pork is the most popular way to do it. It's relatively inexpensive. So that should get – yeah, and that now, if you want to do an aspic, you can do a tomato aspic if you really want to.
I feel like we have to maybe try it, you know, just to say we did.
Oh, and stuffed potatoes, twice-baked potatoes.
That sounds great. What would you do for a dessert?
I think we got to hit the Jell-O thing. No, you're not going to go there. No. You know what was really a big deal? Baked Alaska.
Oh, I've heard of it. I've never made that.
Well, this is pretty spectacular. I have to say, it still holds true today. Here's the deal. You want a cake, just a flat piece of cake that's about an inch and a half thick, mm-hmm. and shaped however you would like it. It could be a round, it could be a rectangle. Okay. And often what you do is you cover with foil a pan of some sort or a cookie sheet.
Sure.
And then you freeze ice cream that's in the shape of that particular cake, but okay. with about an inch smaller. So you got a rim. And that can all be waiting for you. And then you can make a sauce of frozen raspberries that you puree, and then you run through a sieve and you simmer them with a little bit of liqueur and sugar and vanilla. That would be classic in those days. But the thing that you do then is you whip egg whites with sugar, okay, mm-hmm. and you pile them on. Do more egg whites than you think you'll ever need. And you'll find recipes online for this. But anyway, you pile it on. The idea is you want to cover that entire thing so that it's this big fluffy dome with peaks and whatever. And you have the oven at a very high temperature, like maybe 400. And you put it in the oven until the meringue is golden. And the meringue is insulating the ice cream. And then you whisk it to the table.
Okay.
Yeah, remember, Isaac Mizrahi said, hit them with the best thing you got at the beginning and the best thing that you've got at the end, and they'll think you are the most brilliant genius in all the world.
Well, that sounds perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, give us a report. Let us know how it turns out.
All right. Thanks, Lynn.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Baked Alaska. You know, if you've never tried it for the holidays, fabulous. 800-537-5252. And we have Susie calling from Rogers, Ohio. Susie, welcome. What do you want to talk about?
Thank you. I need your help. I need a recipe for vintage cloverleaf rolls that my grandma used to make back in the 60s and 70s.
Okay. This is what you are going to do. You are going to look for a white bread recipe. Sometimes it's called American white bread. Sometimes it's just called white bread. But what it will have in it is some butter, milk, and a bit of sugar. And this is what essentially the Parker House rolls were made from, with a little extra sugar in them. And as I remember, I think it was an egg glaze. Did your mother brush stuff on top of them?
You know, I was pretty little, but...
Right, I know.
You know, knowing what I know now, I'm sure that she did.
Mm. Then put a little bit of egg on top of them, or a little bit of melted butter, and that gets very golden. But essentially, you make the white bread, and then you shape it.
Well, the way my grandma made... We called them clover leaf, and it was three little balls of dough.
Oh, that she put in the same pan?
Yes.
Oh, what a great...
In a muffin tin.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, what a great idea. Okay, you're there. That's all you need to do. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Take care, Susie. And from Washington, D.C., we've got Ginger calling. Ginger, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, my family makes spring early cookies every Christmas.
Oh.
We've been doing this since I was a little kid. And now my mother's a little bit older, so I've taken over making them. But what I'm finding is I've tried many different recipes and many different methods, but I can't get the stamped imprint to stay after when it's baking. It's there when the cookie dries, and I'm watching it when it's baking, and it's there for a while, and then at a certain point, the cookie just rises too much and the design disappears.
Why don't you explain what the spring... It's, how do you pronounce it correctly?
Springerly? At least Springerly. That's how I pronounce
Springerly.
It.
Yeah. Why don't you explain exactly what this is?
Well, from what I understand, it's a German cookie and it's anise flavored. And it's almost like a biscotti. At least the recipe I have only has four ingredients. It's just sugar, flour, eggs, and anise oil. And then you roll it out, and you do either an imprint stamp on it, or we have a rolling pin that has a series of, you know, imprints on it. You roll it out, and then you let the cookies dry for about a day before you bake them. And then you bake them, and then you let them sit for a couple weeks to enhance the flavor.
Oh, yes. And as I remember, they're quite pale and and crunchy.
Well, they should be crunchy, but I'm taking them out of the oven a little bit early to keep a little bit of the design.
I wonder.
So they're not, it's like I'm having to trade off.
Is your dough perhaps too soft?
You know, I've tried adding more dough, and I'm wondering, because the pans I have now, the pans I grew up with, you know, the cookie pans were very thin. The ones I have are like the professional cookie pans.
Are they dark?
Well, they're heavy.
Why don't you go back to an inexpensive cookie sheet?
Okay, you think that will...
I'm not quite sure, because usually, for instance, if you have an abundance of sugar in a cookie,
okay,
sugar liquefies in cookies.
Okay.
And if you have an abundance of sugar, sometimes the cookie gets soft. By the way, the genius in this area of talking about what makes cookies do what they do is Shirley Currier. She's a food scientist who's just brilliant. She also does wonderful recipes. And she did a book called Bake Wise. And if you like to bake, it's an essential book because it has great recipes, but it's a teaching book.
Oh,
and
great.
Boy, yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, if you want a moist cookie, do this with the recipe. If you want a crisp cookie, do that with the recipe. It's that kind of thing. Of course, I'm having trouble remembering it all, but sugar liquefies. So look at the amount of sugar in the recipe. Now, it always worked for your mom, right?
She lost a little bit of the design, too. But, I mean, I was little, so I probably wasn't paying it as much attention to
right,
that
of course you were.
As I am now.
I would say, first try the regular old-fashioned cookie sheet.
Okay.
Try that, number one. Then try cutting back a bit on the sugar.
Okay.
Okay? How many cups of flour, how many cups of sugar?
2 cups of sugar and powdered sugar and 4 cups of cake flour.
All right. Why don't you do 2 cups of powdered sugar? Why don't you drop 1/4 cup of the powdered sugar?
Okay.
Which is not a huge amount in terms of taste.
Would the cooking temperature make a difference, too?
Yes. What is, I mean, I don't, have you changed the cooking temperature?
No, I'm following it. It has you put it in the oven for the first 5 minutes at 200 or 375,
mm-hmm.
and then you drop it down to 300.
It's so a I guess drying it's process kind of, as well as a cooking process.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, should I drop it even lower so it's
no.
a slower cook? Would that prevent the rise?
No, but do you have an oven thermometer in the oven?
Not in the oven, no.
You get an oven thermometer for the oven.
Okay.
All right. And make sure your oven is right, because what could be happening is your oven is warmer, the cookies are springing a bit. Just double
okay.
check that temperature. And the first thing to do is do a tiny batch just with the thinner cookie sheet and the oven thermometer.
Okay.
If it doesn't work the way you want it, do another batch with both of those things plus cutting back on the sugar.
Okay.
I
that
think
like a
that
great idea.
Yeah, that should help you out.
Okay.
And I'll you've got my mouth watering. They're so beautiful, these cookies.
They are. They're very special. And
oh, they are.
Ideally, I guess she said her grandmother used to make them, and she would hold them for a year. So you were always eating the previous year's cookie. And that way the cookie had a year to actually gain a lot of taste.
To have enough to last a year would be my dream.
That's the hard part.
Ginger, enjoy and let us know what happens.
I will. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Hey, remember, you can call us anytime you want, 800-537-5252. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. And be sure to stay in touch. Facebook, Twitter, leave us a message, splendidtable.org. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Irena Chalmers, who said, "In this uncertain world, the food is disposable. It's the wrappings that are permanent." Head to our website, splendidtable.org, to find almost everything you'll ever need. You can register for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our website is managed by Chip Walton. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for listening. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.